Thank you all for coming tonight. One of the best rewards of teaching is to see one's students do well. That makes tonight's reading more than a reading. It's a celebration. It's a homecoming for four of our graduates, and I'm delighted to welcome them back and to welcome you all here to discover, or in some cases, rediscover their works. We have with us tonight Lee Marshall, Patty Smith, Audrey Walls, and Katie Resch George. We've arranged a tag team format for introductions, so I'll be introducing Katie, who will introduce Lee, who will introduce Patty, who will introduce Audrey. When Katie Resch George started her MFA program here, she could neither read nor write, and we taught her everything she knows. And that's the piece of fiction we'll use to start the evening. Here's the nonfiction version. That Katie Resch George has an excellent book of short stories is one of the least surprising things anyone can say about her. From the moment she arrived at VCU, she established herself as a towering talent. She writes with a poet's sensibility, but she also knows how to move a narrative forward, and she places them in situations driven by tension. She knows when to take lyrical leaps. She knows how to let action reveal character. She knows how to establish momentum that will keep a reader reading, and in this age of social media and short attention spans, that's becoming more and more a major victory for the literary arts. In some ways, this first collection is reminiscent of Hemingway's first collection, In Our Time, in that both collections are a mix of brief vignettes and longer narratives. There are differences, of course. Katie does a better job portraying women. She apparently learned a great lesson from Hemingway, though, who always maintained that the most important line of a story was the first one, because that's the line that has to convince the reader to keep going. Listen to this sample of first lines from Katie's stories. A few hours before I flew with my dad and sister to Walt Disney World, Irina assaulted her English teacher with a book. In high school, I loved a boy who shaved his head with a hunting knife. A few days after Cindy Hagen was killed, we gathered on the south lawn around a hole dug in the earth. The boy didn't care that he was tall enough this year. Each of these first lines raises questions to keep us reading, which is exactly what first lines are supposed to do. She then follows up with second lines that do the same, and third lines, and fourth lines, and so on. And before you know it, you're immersed in the world, the lives of people you haven't met before, but whose stories you feel compelled to stay with until the end. Exposure is a wonderful debut collection, and I'd bet the ranch it's only the first of many. Katie is proof, also, that there is such a thing as life after the MFA. Besides publishing her first collection, she's received artist grants from the Barbara Deming Memorial Fund for Women and Richmond Cultural Works. She's also worked as the grants director for the Visual Arts Center here in town, where the graduate students hold our movable feast readings. So she hasn't wandered too far from her old mailbox at Hibbs. But let's still welcome home our dear friend, Katie Resch George.
Wow, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much, Clint. I'm knocked out by that introduction. It is such an honor to be invited to participate in this event tonight. I loved my time in the MFA program at VCU. I learned so much from my mentors, Clint being among them, Tom DeHaven and Suzanne Kokel. It was just a really phenomenal experience, and I'm really proud to receive my MFA here and to call the writers who are going to read after me, my colleagues. I'm going to read two of those more lyrical vignettes that Clint mentioned. When I was deciding what to read for you tonight, I wanted to read things that I could take to completion to give you two whole stories. Clint already read the first sentence to the third prophecy, so I'll read the rest of them. The third prophecy. In high school, I loved a boy who shaved his head with a hunting blade. We drove around our river village in his Jeep, smoking hand-rolled cigarettes and listening to metal or folk music, depending on his mood. Sometimes he kissed me at every stop sign. Sometimes he clenched his face in fierce concentration, the focus of which I never knew. If I asked, he grunted or said, "Fuck off," and was the most beautiful boy I'd ever seen. After school, we made out in the woods near the water, not because our parents were home, but because Jake wanted to spend time in the wild. "When the world ends," he said, "and it will, soon, this is where we're going to end up. It'll start with fire in the sky, massive explosions," he said, and dragged his knife along his prickly scalp, wiped the stubble on his jeans. He called this the third prophecy and took classes at the Apache Scout Survival School, which required expensive gear and camping trips. It surprised me that his father, who called Jake a savage, let him go. We went hiking deep in the forest, and he identified the plants you could eat or crush into a salve, the tracks of deer or foxes, and how long ago they'd been made. When it got warm, he took off his t-shirt and tucked it into his waistband. Walking behind him, I watched the muscles roll beneath his moist skin and thought he had the body of a man. Later, he told me he never once lifted a dumbbell, that the Creator had designed him for his purpose. Sometimes Jake stayed at his mom's house and slept on a thin mat on the floor, the way he liked. But he wasn't technically allowed to stay there. At his father's, his mattress was a California King, a perfect square he had to sleep on with the door open. Once, his mom went cycling through Nova Scotia for 3 weeks without telling anyone. Once, she let us drink gin and tonic with her and said, "If your husband's secretary gives him cufflinks for Christmas, that means he's fucking her." Once, his father called me Lynn, the name of Jake's last girlfriend, and said it was tough to tell Jake's whores apart. Jake balled his hands into fists, big ones, but his father's were bigger. Weekdays, his father wore a diamond tie pin to his law firm. Weekends, he rode his Harley. Once, I fingered the indent on Jake's temple, the size of a pinky ring, and he swatted at my hand. Once, Jake pulled over on the highway to weep at the sunset, and all I could do was pick my chipped nails. After Jake became a Shadow Scout, he drove us to the Pine Barrens, taking his hand from my knee only to shift gears. He'd heard that infants had been abandoned there and were now children who lived like wolves and grunted their language. He would find them and teach them the Apache way. He scorched the end of a stick and rubbed its ashes on our clothes and skin to make us blend into the forest. He told me not to show my teeth. I tried to step lightly as he instructed. I didn't know what would happen to him if I snapped a twig. He built a primitive shelter strewn with smoke grass and said the wolf children would smell it and come to us. For the first time, I didn't believe him. Still, I pulled the fronds up by their roots. Then it grew so dark, I begged to go home. He drove us back without blinking and glared at me for the last time. Have you ever tripped in public and felt relieved from embarrassment because somehow no one saw you, then went and told the first person you talked to that you just fell? I've talked about Jake, how he cut his hand through the air, saying, "If you ask the earth kindly, she'll let you conduct the wind," or how he sliced himself, sharpening a knife, and wrote a love letter to me with his blood, or how he hacked his guitar to pieces when his father mocked his playing and saved the wood in his pack to build a fire with when the time came, how he wanted the time to come. Sometimes I talked about Jake the way someone laughs at herself for having fallen, but that's not how I felt. The letter turned rosy brown and stank of carrion, but not for too long. The next story I'm going to read is the title story of the collection, Exposure. It's another short one. Exposure. At 2 o'clock on New Year's morning, a man in Chicago leaves a party. Walking home, he slips on a patch of ice and falls, bashes his head on the edge of a bench. He loses consciousness and lies on the sidewalk until well after daybreak, his body obscured by a mound of plowed snow. That afternoon, a Channel 6 news anchor reviews his top stories. The tragedy of Stephen Cox, 37, husband and expectant father, found dead in Lincoln Park due to exposure is not, in the anchor's opinion, the worst tragedy to report, yet it distresses him most. In makeup, he protects his lapels with a paper bib and thinks of Stephen Cox's open coat, a dress coat with no liner, a gentleman's coat. The image of such a coat starts a vibration in the anchor's mind, the story eclipsing all others because it flirts with his memory, as though there is a reason for his sympathy for Stephen Cox that only his deep memory knows. Perplexed, he phones his sister. Leaving her shift at the clinic, the psychiatric nurse answers her brother's call on her mobile. She says, "A London fog, maybe?" When he asks what their father had worn during winters, her brother presses, "Do we know someone who died like this?" But the nurse is tired and without reflecting answers, "No." All day, the nurse has tried to soothe a patient, a young woman who believes herself to be made of paper and fears bright lights will set her on fire. The nurse has little patience left for her brother. He sighs, "Stephen Cox, poor bastard." And for a moment, the nurse brightens. She reminds him of Brian Cox, her college boyfriend. Maybe that's who you're thinking of. Later, the nurse attends a movie at the Science Museum. For the new year, she has resolved to wear heels twice a week to meet new people somehow. The acclaimed film documents explorers as they climb Mount Everest. As she sits in the crowded theater, the nurse thinks of seeing movies with Brian Cox, how they kissed in the back row and held hands and sometimes let their hands travel. On the screen, falling snowflakes land on the camera lens and wetly blur the image of the explorers, and the nurse recalls the translucent paper her patients use for origami. Once, spilled water dissolved a row of folded swans to pulp, and her young woman patient was inconsolable. Two of the explorers in the film are a married couple who set up camp at the base of the final peak. They have come so far, but at night the man shivers violently and struggles to breathe in the altitude until his wife holds an oxygen mask to his mouth. She secures the closures on his yellow parka. The theater is bright with the white light of the snow, and the nurse can see the man next to her lean into the woman on his other side as though comforting her or comforting himself. Who knows, the nurse thinks, what else is happening in their life, and understands that to hold hands in a theater is to be in the theater, but somewhere else, too. To hold hands in a theater is to say, I am watching this movie, but I am also in this life that I share with this person. I bring this life with me wherever I go. Her own hands in her lap and cold, the nurse curls her fingers. Thank you. Thanks. Those are the two stories I'll read from the book tonight. I'm really excited to sit down and listen to the three readers who will all get to enjoy tonight. So it is my pleasure to introduce Lee Marshall. And we graduated the same year, I think, right? Yes, so I had the pleasure of getting to hear Lee read at our Movable Feast events over 3 years. She was always a star of the night. So Lee Marshall's work has appeared in Thrush, Limebreak, Diode, Poetry Journal, Hayden's Ferry Review, Body, Broad Street Magazine, and elsewhere and elsewhere. Her manuscript was recently named a finalist for the Crab Orchard First Book Award in Poetry. In addition to poetry, Lee writes about dance for local and national publications and serves as associate chair of the VCU's Department of Dance and Choreography. She has described her time as an MFA student and working mother as the best 12 years of my life.
Thank you very much, Katie. I have a few poems to read this evening, and the first one is going to predictably involve dance and also astronomy, because astronomy keeps showing up in my poems, so I've kind of given into it. Dancer 3. The most common case of an event horizon is that surrounding a black hole. Light emitted from beyond the horizon can never reach the outside observer. The edge of the curtain, its slow and heavy velvet, her event horizon. She ignites, passing from the cave of the wing to the stage, merciless, wielding your gaze in strokes of anger, longing, or confusion. Her wrists, the long tendons of her neck, her heels shot with electricity and salt. In front of you, she loses time, she becomes it. Watching, you endlessly create her out of darkness. You cannot be contained, she cannot be measured. This next poem, a few years ago, I participated in a 30 Poems in 30 Days project through Tupelo Press, and you had to produce a poem every day that was published online. It was quite terrifying, but some of the poems I found to be salvageable, and so I was glad to have generated so much work in such short a time. This one is called Right Hand, which was written waiting in the jury room when I wrote this poem. These informational booklets on jury service were printed before 9/11, so they will tell you that knitting in the court building is fine. It's not now. You may not knit here. Some sections are no longer true. Many are true. You are important. If you are struck from service, do not be offended. We needed you. We needed you. Trial by jury is a cornerstone. Capital punishment may be a penalty for some felonies. You must determine the truth. How does a vine reach toward a scaffold it can't yet touch? All we want is for you to determine the truth and then tell us what it is. You are important. We are afraid. This is a grim little poem inspired by words that my daughter Rowan spoke. It's called Mercy. My daughter says to her papa in camouflage, "If I were a deer, I would tell you not to shoot me, but I would show you some deer who are really, really sick, who need to be killed." And on her little hoofs, she would walk him through the woods, her white tail never flickering to where her friends were waiting. I really love that, but it's horrible. The next poem is actually words that a friend of mine helped start a birth center in Uganda. And it's a traditional birth center staffed by local midwives. And one of the women's birth stories was posted. So the words are from Atim Dorcas, who gave birth in the birth center in Atiak. And I read her birth story and thought, this is amazing. And I just basically put it in a shape. Atim Dorcas's story, the birth of baby Rachel Christine, Atiak, Uganda. I said I wanted to have a gentle birth. The moment I stepped into the birth center, I found a woman. I found a woman. I am wondering how I can let her know about myself. Will she? The real meaning of labor pains knocks my head at midnight. I am drowning. The sounds of women laboring becomes like a song, all of us together. Walk the baby down. Five midwives gave me all their energy. It was time for seriousness. I am mother. I brought to life. I was jubilating. The team of midwives that works like the bees. This is another 30-30 poem called Imprint. The moment before a bomb explodes belongs to the market hagglers, the oo of pigeons, the tenderness of shoplifters, the great rushing silence of passing cars, the worn place on one woman's heel and how she ignores it, belongs to their collective ignorance of how the bomb will dismantle not only people, pigeons, walked dogs, but the space they inhabit, will slam the air apart to a void, punctured by feathers, a young girl's arm, the dead listening to the difference between the silence before and the silence after. This is called Five. One learned to swim alone at night in a shallow pond, splashing brown water and sycamore leaves until she buoyed. Another grew lilies taller than her child had been and bright yellow. Another carried salt in her pocket in case of need. Another moved stones from place to place and found this changed nothing. The last one walked, so she could tell those who asked how she planted her feet and peeled them from the earth, how each step holds both greeting and farewell. It also is a 30-30 poem, probably written in a moment of desperation. The cynical astronomer on love. Venus, apparently, has such a thick atmosphere that observers on the surface can see neither sun nor stars. How appropriate. This goes out to my poet wife, Audrey Walls, because it apparently is one of her favorites from the annals of my MFA history. It is a sonnet about roasting a chicken and also love. It's called On Roasting. Hefting a chicken and holding a string, your voice returns to me unbidden. Please, against my neck that long, slick afternoon. I shut out your whisper and stuff butter and garlic down the chest cavity. Cleaned, plucked, cold weight on my fingers. It needs salt. But kaleidoscopic, those crystals resolve into your face jeweled in sweat, saltier than the fowl I grip to forget. Unresponsive, its spine ignores these final insults. I tie down its small elbows, twine a slow unwinding. Your scarf curls slowly off your neck, windblown. Hunched over chicken, sprinkling limbs with thyme. The oven's hot, my will, that bird, has flown. This last, well, almost last poem is also inspired by young Rowan from several years ago when you were much younger. It's called Ergo Sum. I used to set pennies on the train tracks past my grandmother's house, even after someone told me this could derail the train. My daughter says she controls the weather. Childhood's consuming longing for agency. I am here. I am powerful. I am terrified. Mama, she says, I want to always live with you, even after we die, to be fossils with you, and we will always be touching. We will always be touching. And the last thing I want to share with you is I do have a chapbook, and I couldn't really read to you from it because there aren't poems in it, because the idea that I had for this chapbook was I was thinking a lot about agency and who gets to write and who gets to be heard and published. And I thought, what if there was a book of just fragments that then the reader could write themselves? And so that's what this is. It was published just basically 2 weeks ago by Dancing Girl Press. But the title of the chapbook essentially is a poem that sort of tells you how to go about it. So I will finish with this. It's called Title. Here is what I want you to do. I want you to write these poems. I want your throat to hurt writing these poems. Sing or die. We are at the edge anyway. Write them in pen, pencil, spit, dirt, blood. Write what you want. Write the end. Write change. Write underwater, torn pages. Write with me, because there is no point shouting alone, and I want you heard. Thank you. I am pleased to introduce Patty Smith as our next reader. Patty is the author of the novel The Year of Needy Girls. She received her MFA from Virginia Commonwealth University in 2001. Her nonfiction has appeared in the anthologies One Teacher in Ten, Gay and Lesbian Educators Tell Their Stories, Tied in Knots, Funny Stories from the Wedding Day, Something to Declare, Good Lesbian Travel Writing, and One Teacher in Ten in the New Millennium, LGBT Teachers Discuss What Has Gotten Better and What Hasn't. Her work has also appeared in such places as Salon, Broad Street, Prime Number, Gris Gris, The Tusculum Review, and So to Speak. Patty Smith.
Hello, everybody. It's so good to see you all. And thank you, thank you, thank you to VCU for having me. This is really a treat and a dream come true, really. I'm going to read from the beginning of The Year of Needy Girls, just so that you can get a sense of what the novel's about. And then I'm going to read from two short, very short sections, one kind of midway and then one right towards the end. So here we go. The air, electric, buzzes and hums. It's the end of August, one of those humid, still Saturdays, the city empty or holding its breath. East of the river, near the abandoned textile mill and the old shoe warehouse, Leo Rivera rides his bicycle, a 10-speed, hand-me-down from his brothers. He pays no mind to the heat. Leo stands and pumps past a vacant lot, one of several in his neighborhood, littered with broken glass that sparkles in the sun. Tufts of stiff, burnt grass poke through cracks in the concrete, and red plastic milk crates sit overturned and empty in the lot, waiting for the men who will gather there later to drink beer and listen to the game. Through the open window of a shingled brown triple-decker, he hears Portuguese, the same radio station his mother listens to, the same one that will broadcast the soccer match this afternoon, Brazil versus Chile. Leo likes soccer, but unlike his brothers, he prefers baseball. Best of all, he likes riding his bike. He pedals hard past the chain-link fence of his school, Most Precious Blood Elementary, MPB, they all call it, and the hot, tarred blacktop, where he will be having recess again in a few short days. He whizzes past Most Precious Blood Church and the white sign that advertises Wednesday night bingo in the parish hall next door. His grandmother is a regular. She wins, but not big, not enough to buy him a new bike, which he wants more than anything, which he covets. He doesn't covet anyone else's bike, just a Trek he has seen advertised in a magazine, but he knows that wanting things and praying for them is bad. Greed, the MPB sisters say, is a sin. Not a mortal one like killing, but a venial one, a misdemeanor. Leo tries to avoid wanting the bike outright because he doesn't like to disappoint the sisters at MPB, but worst of all, he doesn't like disappointing his mother. His mother tells him that he is her pride and joy, the one born in America. Does he know how lucky he is to be living in a country where his father can get decent work, that he and his brothers can go to good schools? He must thank God for America, his mother tells him, every night. He must pray and thank God for sending them all to this good country. The American boy doesn't know any other country. He hears the stories, and he thinks he is the luckiest of all to not know anything but America. This city, this neighborhood where he goes to school and plays baseball, this land of shiny bicycles. At night when he is saying his prayers, always thanking God for America, Leo slips and tries to make deals about how he will help his mother and how he will do all his homework if he could just get that Trek for his birthday. His birthday isn't for weeks, but he is thinking about it now, riding past the library, past the empty Little League field with the backstop halfway torn down, past the mechanic shop where Mickey, his next-door neighbor, works part-time. Mickey is almost a friend. He's much older, but he helps Leo with his bike, lubes the chain for him, or replaces it outright like he did at the beginning of summer. Leo was thinking of his birthday and how much he would like to ride that trek to school and show his friends. He won't even mind the helmet his mother makes him wear. He won't complain ever about the helmet he promises God. So when Leo coasts down the sidewalk toward his grandmother's house, a white triple-decker surrounded by a chain-link fence, and Mickey is waiting, sitting in the passenger seat of a car alongside the curb, engine still running, Leo is only thinking of his trek, seeing himself on the first day of school, riding to MPB on the shiny bike. He isn't thinking how strange it is that Mickey is here waiting for him. No, he's only thinking of his birthday and the way it will be when his mother leads him to the dining room. Mickey calls Leo out the car window and tells him to hop in. In the driver's seat, a man Leo doesn't recognize flicks his cigarette butt onto the sidewalk where it lands next to Leo's sneaker. Mickey says he's found the bike. He will buy it if it's the one Leo wants. Mickey can't remember if it's a Trek or not. He thinks it is. It'll just take a second. He's seen the bike in a shop downtown and it isn't too expensive. If they go right now, if Leo will just get in the car, it'll just take a minute. His grandmother won't know he's gone. She doesn't even know he's here yet. Then Mickey'll know whether or not it's the bike to buy for Leo's birthday. They'll bring him right back, they promise. So his grandmother won't worry. They put his Schwinn in the trunk. If she sees the bike lying in the yard, we don't want her wondering where you are, do we? Mickey says. Leo agrees and climbs in the back seat. Mickey's friend, the driver, smiles in the rearview mirror. You like bikes, huh? This is too good to be true. This is maybe some crazy dream. This is chapter one. At 7:30, with SJ still asleep, Deirdre Murphy left the house for school. She walked side streets shaded by trees in their glory, pale autumn reds, yellows the color of honey. She scuffed through piles of leaves, each whoosh a reminder of every other autumn and every other beginning of the school year, the only way Deirdre knew how to mark time. She kept track of events based on the girls she taught. the drama queens, the freaks, the year they all were brilliant. This year, Deirdre could already tell after a week of classes, was the year of needy girls. Each house that Deirdre passed, she tried on. These were not houses meant for her with their mansard roofs, turrets, and gables. They were dream houses only, forever inaccessible. Still, she pictured herself making coffee in that one, eating breakfast on the porch of this one, working in the garden, pulling weeds after school. She imagined herself alone in the houses, NPR on the radio, while she cooked dinners with ingredients she grew herself. In Deirdre's mind, the interiors of the houses were tidy and looked like the magazine pictures she flipped through in the grocery store checkout line. Artfully draped afghans, throw pillows just so, old books piled alongside the fireplace, dust-free, all of it. The pictures, so sharp and real they made her ache with longing, became fuzzy if she tried to include SJ. Then the images slipped away, and she was back on the outside looking in. 70 September degrees, blue, blue sky. Who could tell that just days before, Hurricane Rita had blown through canceling school, or that over in the East End, the Rivera family was mourning their missing child. Outside, the city was moving. Men and women, courier bags slung over their shoulders, hurried toward the train station to catch the commuter rail into Boston. A steady stream of familiar cars crawled by on the street, the carpool brigade on its way to Brandywine Academy. An institution in town, Brandywine was in many ways a typical private school, small with a kind of clubby feel about it, catering to the more prominent families in Bradley, Massachusetts, with girls whose last names were Saltonstall, Hallowell, Conant, Fitzgerald. Except for the fact that it was surrounded by a blacktop and a parking lot, Brandywine could be mistaken for another of the larger houses in the neighborhood. But there it was, next door to the Blue Moon Cafe, the favorite hangout of Brandywine parents, the ones who didn't work or who drove carpools in the mornings and the afternoons. On the front door of the Blue Moon, Leo Rivera's face fluttered from a flyer with taped corners, smiling in that blue Red Sox cap. Deirdre pushed the door open, breathed in freshly ground coffee, rich, buttery croissants. Frances Worthington and Evelyn Moore, the mothers of Deirdre's two neediest sophomores, sat huddled at a table off to the side and toward the rear. Frances, with her back, doing all the talking, elbows bent at her side, she twirled manicured hands in the air. Frances was the president of the board at Brandywine, and her husband, a child psychologist, enjoyed a successful private practice. He was pretty famous and appeared from time to time on morning talk shows. Around town, word was that he was having an affair, the former babysitter, a girl closer in age to his own daughter, but the talk shows never mentioned that. Little section, this is in the middle. Autumn meant field hockey, cheering on the sidelines, yelling out the girls' names. You could be passionate about them here, wearing your Brandywine sweatshirt, school spirit on visible display. You could love the girls openly, a kind of parental love and pride that was acceptable. When you were learning to be a teacher, taking graduate classes and methods, sitting in lectures about differentiation or the plight of the gifted child, no one talked about the most difficult thing, how you were going to love the kids you taught, how you might even love them inappropriately or want them for your own, how you had to learn not to resent the parents. No one facilitated a discussion about the possible disasters waiting to happen if you mistakenly forgot that you were the teacher and the kids were your students, not your children, and not, God forbid, your friends. But it was sometimes difficult to remember this. Deirdre couldn't talk to anyone about how she felt, not even SJ, especially not SJ, who was already judgmental about the amount of time Deirdre spent at Brandywine, the hours she spent agonizing over the girls' private lives, which SJ liked to remind her were private. "Do you have to go to every home game?" SJ often complained. "You do get to take time for yourself, you know." But if Deirdre missed a game, then she might miss Anna's biggest goal, and then she would feel terrible, like she had let the girl down and missed an important moment in her young life. She wanted the girls to take her seriously in the classroom, she tried to explain to SJ, and if she showed them that their lives mattered to her, they were more likely to listen in class and learn. The truth was, Deirdre loved attending the field hockey games. The long autumn afternoons, a kind of symphonic lull in the middle of the city. The field, located a few miles from Brandywine, did double duty. Used both for youth soccer league as well as the field hockey games, it was surrounded by oaks and maples and made you feel as though you were not in Bradley with its factories and triple deckers, but out in another part of the state, in one of those picturesque New England towns with its own private school, the kind with glossy catalogs and a campus, the kind of place with big town greens where festivals were held and rich people retired, the kind of place in which the West Enders pretended they all lived, forgetting about the East End that was, in spite of their amnesia, part of Bradley. Here at the games, Deirdre stood near the cluster of parents, mothers mostly, dressed in smart-looking outfits, all in inappropriate footwear, heeled boots or cute slip-ons that did not navigate dampened fields effectively. Their hair, Deirdre noticed, always looked newly cut and styled, smooth and shiny, not the mess that hers inevitably turned into after a full day of teaching. Next to the mothers, she felt unlovely, but she tried to reassure herself that no matter what, the girls wanted her here, and in some cases, wanted her here even more than they wanted their own mothers. Secretly, Deirdre was thrilled when any of the girls confided in her something they couldn't discuss with their mothers, though she always encouraged them to bring it up at home. "Your mother," she would insist to the girl sitting in front of her, wiping away tears, "she needs to know what you feel. You need to tell her." And when the girl would resist, would say something about how her mother just wouldn't understand, about how it was amazing that Miss Murphy did understand, how it was awesome they had a teacher like her who got them, then Deirdre felt the power she wielded and reveled in it just the tiniest bit. And the last little section. There are a couple sections throughout the book that are told in a third-person omniscient called The Girls, and this is the last one of them. The girls missed their favorite teacher. When she was at school, they had vied for her attention, longed for her words, her input. They feigned disinterest sometimes, but they always knew whether or not she was paying attention. In class, they had craved being near her. It was an addiction like any other. They couldn't get enough, couldn't go one day without being near. On the days they didn't have French, they used to find reasons to stop by. They would ask questions about upcoming assignments or an assembly. Mondays provided the most excuses when they could ask about movies she might have seen on the weekend. In the spring, they all became Red Sox fans, learned enough names to throw them out casually. The girls wouldn't have acknowledged this need to be around Miss Murphy. In all innocence, they would have said that she made them feel important, made them feel heard. They saw in her a way to be a woman, someone other than their mothers, with whom they had complicated relationships. Miss Murphy, they might say, was so smart. She was so interesting. She expanded their world tenfold. And when they went home, they brought her with them, filled the dinner conversation with things they had learned from her. "Did you know?" they would say to their mothers and fathers. "Have you heard?" Their relationship with their French teacher was just short of all-out adoration. Some of them might even admit to a crush. It was common, they had heard, to fall in love with your teachers. Even another girl? Well, yes, they would say. It happens all the time. It wasn't as if some of them weren't equally in love with Mr. Maycomer. They dreamed about him at night and on sleepovers. The young ones would sometimes prank call his house, his number was listed, and hang up when he answered. Almost every teacher had his or her fans, and the girls all imagined that the admiration worked both ways. They knew each teacher's favorites, the girls who were asked to take attendance, to run errands to the office, or to fetch something the teacher had left in the car. They knew who was likely to get the extra detailed letter of recommendation, or who might be asked to run the literary magazine or head up the chess club. None of these things came as a surprise to any of the girls. It is a little discussed fact of high school life that both students and teachers have favorites and are often quite open about their preferences. These girls hated that their favorite had suddenly become an unfavorite of the administration. But what did the administration know about teaching anyway? Not much, the girls were convinced. The girls were surrounded by bad teachers, even at Brandywine. They had their fair share. Teachers who did little more than offer worksheets to complete or homework in the book to be graded the next day in class. It was unimaginative, the girls complained to each other. And why didn't they just get fired? Now, here was Miss Murphy, the best teacher they had, and she was gone. Now, here was Anna Worthington getting all the attention. They knew Anna had been a favorite, and truthfully, while they could tolerate it when Miss Murphy was still their teacher, they had a harder time accepting it now. Thank you. Thank you so much. So I was here a long time ago, so I didn't have the pleasure of studying with these other women that I'm reading with, and I'm so thrilled to be able to discover their work. And it's my pleasure to introduce Audrey Walls. Audrey is the author of a chapbook, Cyanosis, came out from Dancing Girl Press in 2016, and she serves as the poetry editor of the online literary journal Fail Better. Her poetry has recently found homes in Meridian, Permafrost, Poor Claudia, and Quarterly West. And her work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, Best of the Net, and Best New Poets. Please welcome Audrey Walls.
Thanks for sticking around. I just wanted to say first off, like everyone else has said, I'm really grateful to be here. It's really nice to be asked to come and read, which is something you don't really get to do that much of after MFA land. So it's nice to be back, and I'm really glad to be reading with such exceptional talent, and all of us women, how about that? My chapbook is called Cyanosis, and that's the phenomenon that happens when parts of your body literally start turning blue from the colds. Kind of like Raynaud's syndrome, but more intense. The poem that gives the chapbook its title is in three parts, and so it's Cyanosis 1, 2, and 3. So here's the first part of it. It's called Cyanosis 1. How the machinist's hands become one callus after gear and cog, after years of wire. The holly trees so dark, wax night in every leaf. The air is caught in a mason jar. This is how it happens. My ears are dead, my hands are dead, then my feet, my face. I could say I am dead. I would cut off my fingers. Just let me, but nothing. This body, this machinery, my veins a winter creek, every vessel left empty and cold. Cyanosis 2. Nobody teaches you how to be your own keeper, how to create insulation, the layering of synthetics and wool. The wind doesn't care. The wind is just the wind. You fall asleep to the sound of electronic rain in your hotel room while the snowdrifts pile inch upon inch. The trucks here never shed their plows. You must bury yourself in a hole to keep warm. You must bury yourself to keep alive. And Cyanosis Part 3. It was the first year we didn't want winter. The cold was no longer mystery, but fact. How we turn blue, a cyanosis of forgetting. We walk the dog to the lake, her black paws dripping. Below the ice, layers of waste sent off from the town. First the salt sheds, now the factories, their heavy metals, mercury, cobalt, lead. On the shore, the dog prods at a dead fish, tangled in line and hook. I pull her from the carcass. This next one is called Mercury, and it's about mercury. My body is a light bulb. I shake my head and hear the soft singing of a filament broken. 100 clear beads reach my nape and run south. Disconnect, I say, unfurl the clouded air, the stones of my eyes. The moon is high and my knees are bee stung, swollen in the yellow light. I have come here to apologize. I have wanted too much. I disturbed the nest. This is the word for stone. These are the words for ghost. Even though you are still a child, you must know them. Shapeshifter, I cannot offer you safety. I too am only a thief. Half water, half silver, we reel against each other. Our touch has always been poison. For a hot minute, I lived in the suburb on the south side of Richmond. No offense, Southsiders. It almost killed me. Here's a poem about it. It's called Suburban Diatribe. Did I say disaster? I meant orchid. In Florida, they have lizards the length of your arm. That doesn't mean we have to move tomorrow. We could dig a hole in the backyard and bury ourselves. It would do as much good. I said rancor. The neighbors don't blink anymore. They just stare as our windows fog up in the rain, our single-paned horrors. We can't stay. You said listen, but the crickets aren't calling us home. Their song is retreat, retreat, retreat. My dear poet wife and friend, Lee Marshall, read her chicken sonnet. Well, that was all sexy. That was just for me. So she asked me to reciprocate by reading something ghosty, because what was it? And what did you say? We used to have the sex and death duet in workshop. Sex and death, yeah. She would write about sex, I would write about death. So here's a poem that definitely has a ghost in it. It's called Notes from a Mnemonic. You are far from the cinders in the garden, crushed underfoot, where I snap the heads off basil, flowering still after all this loss. I call because I can no longer remember how to find you. Anywhere you are is not here. The blocks are too many for tin cans and string, the concrete warps and cracks. Outside the fence, a woman sobs until each heave shudders her lungs. Dearest, I am too young. All I can do is send this message. The Jewish boy who lived on our street took his life last November. His mother found him, thin body dangling from an orange electrical cord. I call because I want this to mean something. I call for your answer. Listen before we lose this. Cup your ear to the bodies of your children and find me in their narrow breathing. So this is a tiny poem that nobody really likes but me. So I'm going to read it because it's my reading. Damn it, I can do it. In Prague, they actually had a pneumatic post system that had like the tubes and the shoof and all that kind of stuff. So they had this whole system of pneumatic posts where you could actually send messages and do things the same way you used to, like, you know, go to the bank and you'd put your checks in and poof, off it went. And it stayed in place until 2002. So I was like, all right, how about the last telegram sent by pneumatic post? And that's what this is, in my head at least. Dearest, I cannot stay. You know this. I have tried, I have worked my life to dust, but I cannot. Outside the hotel window, they are cutting down the linden trees. As I write this, I cannot breathe. Keep the ring or sell it. You can do what you like now. Who am I to need you? Who was I to ever need you? All right, so my daughter is going to turn 2 next month. So I figured I might as well read a mama poem, because when Lee was in workshop with us, she would always bring in these mama poems and she would be like, I'm sorry, I wrote another mama poem. And at the time I was like, whatever, that's cool. But now I'm like, oh, I get it. I get it now. So this one's called Apology. I don't believe the tears. You can cry all you want, but it won't put you back. The barn is closed, the doctors say. We are done here. You should see what remains. Destroyed fascia, webs of scar tissue, marks as deep as tiger claws. All things said, I still watch you breathe as you sleep. I saved all my knives for my mother, but that doesn't make anything I say right. You are that fiery child, sprinting towards some new danger. Once I was your foxhole, but I will not keep you safe. Whole years will pass without you knowing. Each winter will wash us clean. I don't believe the snow. All right, so my husband, in his infinite wisdom, as I was going through these, said, do you have any poems that end on a high note? Do you have anything funny? Do you have anything that's slightly with the uplift, anything? And I said, do you know me? So here's the closest thing I have to an uplift poem. And this one's going out to Ann Hoffler, because her son, Will, is in a photography class right now at Maggie Walker. And this one is called Unsent Letter to a Young Photographer. It's true. The night we met, I lied, when I admitted I knew about aperture and flash. The house on 12th Street, the party indoors dulled to humdrum. We stood alone beneath the neighbor's choke cherry tree, its fruit like tight fists. The light here is terrible, you said between sighs as we waited for the street lamp's glow. I offered my Marlboro, your smile was a broken window. And even now, it's true. I haven't known you long enough to claim anything, less than a few bolts of blue that rang my body like a bell. But when you hold your camera to your eye, I want what steals you away from me. Don't make me the empty room you seek. I'm not the dead bird or the graffiti. Here is my photograph. It's you, your face obscured by the SLR, your silver-rimmed glasses balanced above black eyebrows, your long shank frame against the alleys of brick and fog. The night you left town, you believed the world was like a circuit, where you were the path and I was the current. When you fly over the dateline, know that I am the fixed point from which you move forward. Know that I may lift the viewfinder to my sight, but I will capture nothing. Know tonight, I am not lying. That's it. Thank you. So that's it for me. That's it for all of us. So it's my duty to send you off into the night. So thank you to everybody for coming out tonight and supporting us. I know I speak for all of us when I say it's a privilege and an honor to be here and to represent the alumni of the MFA program. And since I never turn down the good opportunity to embarrass a colleague, especially one as dear to me as this particular guy, I would like to take one nanosecond to thank Tom Dodato at the English department for putting this on and making sure that most of us MFAers, past and future, graduate with our sanity, at least mostly intact. So that's no hard feat, so there you go. And if you like what you heard tonight, please remember that you can take a piece of the magic home with you, because we have books for sale, and we're all starving artists despite our day jobs. So please, if you like what you heard, grab a copy, sit down, read it, think about it. Thank you for coming out.